Maybe it happens to you a lot. You ask your housemates, do you want to go to the store? And you get an incoherent response like, I'm not on the floor. And then you realize you've been misheard, or maybe you've misspoken. How we deliver speech and how we receive it are at the core of the work of University of Oregon Assistant Professor Melissa Bays-Burke. She works lots of research angles on what people say and what they meant to say. And there are lots of applications for people trying to understand and learn foreign languages. So let's talk about how we send and receive language in this month's edition of Curious, Research Meets Radio. Melissa Bays-Burke is in the Department of Linguistics. She's also the director of the University of Oregon Second Language Acquisition and Teaching Certificate Program. Hi, Dr. Burke. Bays-Burke.
Hi, how are you?
Good. It's good to have you here. This can certainly be fascinating stuff. What got you into this line of work?
I kind of joke that I fell into this work because I was thinking about majoring in French in college, and I had to take a linguistics class, and I took the class and realized that more interesting than French language, which is certainly beautiful and fun to learn, I was really interested in the question of how languages work, and that's at the core of linguistics.
It truly is, particularly with the French language, all those consonants that don't get pronounced and all the different ways that vowels get pronounced. Is it's a great language to have those sorts of questions about, isn't it?
Right.
All right. There's a big splash that you made last year with an article called Revisiting Neil Armstrong's Moon Landing, quote, Implications for Speech Perception, Function Word Reduction, and Acoustic Ambiguity. You were the lead author. What got that research started?
We started that project around the time that Neil Armstrong passed away, and we had read these really interesting articles that said that Armstrong had insisted that when he landed on the moon, he said one small step for a man, one giant leap for mankind. And of course, that's not how most of us learned the quote in history class in school. We learned it without the one small step for man. And I was really interested in this because it was parallel to a lot of work we were doing about how we perceive these really small words, which we call function words, words like and of. And it turns out those words are really susceptible to disappearing perceptually, even when they are produced by people. And so we thought this might be a really nice real-world test case for some of our hypotheses about how we produce speech and how we eventually unpack and understand it as a listener.
You know, I remember watching that as it happened in 1969, and with all the damn beeping and the garbles from a quarter of a million miles away, I mean, it's not surprising that there was a little misunderstanding about it. Particularly, I now remember Walter Cronkite a few minutes later saying, we're told now that this is what he said.
Right. Yeah, I mean, the recording conditions were certainly less than ideal, you know, being recorded from the moon with all the static and information that you're getting from NASA. And Neil Armstrong planned that speech in advance, and so they provided that speech to the media. But he insisted for years that he actually did say it, and so that sent a lot of linguists on a hunt for the missing right, in the actual recordings, and they weren't able to find anything conclusive. And so we took a different angle and said, well, could he have said it? Does the acoustic signature look consistent with either for or for a? And then could we get people to actually misperceive other instances of for a, where we know the is actually produced, as for? So could we, you know, kind of trick people into misperceiving it using some of those same conditions? So we could have looked at noise, but we chose to look at speaking rate. It turns out he was speaking really, really slowly. And it turns out when you speak slowly, those little function words, if you speak them quickly, are more susceptible to disappearing.
So if he'd said the ah quickly, but the rest of his speech was slow, they could miss it easily?
Exactly.
Huh. I mean, and with all of today's analytical gadgets, and you could put these things onto color monitors and all that sort of stuff, the waveforms, could you say definitively that he did say it?
We couldn't say definitively whether he did say it. Unfortunately, even with today's technology, the tricky part for us is getting rid of all of the noise and the other beeps and that sort of stuff. The other problem is that it turns out you can say for and for a and have them look exactly the same in terms of the waveform. Obviously, if you're hyper-articulating or saying things very clearly, they'll look different. But if you say them rather quickly, they can look almost exactly identical. And so it's very hard to say for sure whether the was actually produced.
Wow. So there's some difference in meaning there, obviously, depending on whether he said one step for man or one step for a man. But the fact is, what this probably points out to is that this happens all the time. We really take speech for granted and assume that exactly what we said is exactly what's going to be perceived. And it's not like that at all, is it?
No. I mean, the amazing thing is that humans actually do misperception very rarely. We do a pretty good job of understanding the intended meaning, in part because we use all sorts of other cues to help us unpack the speech signal. But the speech signal in and of itself is really, really variable, and it's really, really inconclusive in terms of just the signal itself. So if I play you words in isolation without any context, you're going to be much more likely to misunderstand those words than if they're in some sort of context. And so we're really interested in what those things are that actually help you understand speech, and especially because we take those things for granted in our everyday communication, which is so important for our success in life.
Melissa Bays-Burke is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, assistant professor in the Department of Linguistics at the University of Oregon and director of the University of Oregon's Second Language Acquisition and Teaching Certificate Program. She's our guest in this month's edition of Curious, Research Meets Radio. And you can join the conversation on the Exchange. Are there things that you could swear you heard other people say and they insisted, no, I didn't say that? I mean, did you get garbled either in sending or receiving language in your life? It's probably happened a few times. 800-838-3760 to join the conversation by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. You could probably write a book alone, Melissa, on mistaken song lyrics.
Yeah, mistaken song lyrics are fantastic cases of when we actually do misperceive things. And the reason why those happen more frequently than mistaken just speech, plain speech, is because songs actually end up taking away a lot of the information that we use to help us figure out what words are said, right? So pitch is a big one that we use in speech, and that's used for different purposes in song lyrics than it is in speech, and rhythm and rate information similarly.
Yeah, I was thinking about the fact that, I mean, honestly, the sounds are there for Jimi Hendrix to have said, excuse me while I kiss this guy, but he's actually saying, excuse me while I kiss this guy.
Exactly. The other great examples are Elton John's Hold Me Closer, Tiny Dancer being misperceived as Tony Danza. So there are plenty of really great examples of this, and they're often very humorous because they're close enough. You can see how someone could get there, but that's not the intent of the singer in this case.
And, of course, it's a laughing thing for us when it comes to song lyrics, but I noticed that a fair amount of your research of late focuses on international students, on how they speak or how their teachers understand them or how they learn the language.
Yeah, the focus is on all three of those angles, actually. A bulk of the research on non-native students has focused primarily on how to improve their speech, and that's certainly something that a lot of folks are interested in. We have a lot of students at the University of Oregon who come to the U of O to learn English in our American English Institute before they join the ranks of the students in the university setting. But at the same time, we have to realize that there are more non-native speakers of English in the world now than there are native speakers of English. So there has to be some responsibility taken by the listener as well to help the listener better understand the speaker. And so I work on both angles of this to try to figure out how non-native speakers learn the language, but also on how native and non-native listeners can better understand speech that might otherwise present some sort of communication challenge.
Does that go to the extent, for example, of giving some advisories to the people who are listening? You might hear this because this is what happens in the other language, for example.
Yeah, so we're really interested in doing training. We've done some training in the past that just simply exposes people to non-native speech. And we've found that if you expose people to a lot of different accents, they're better equipped to understand new accents and accents they've already heard. They're much better than people who haven't received such exposure or have received only exposure to one accent background. The question of what needs to go into that training is an open one and something that we're continuing to look at in my lab and in other labs across the country.
Well, let's take a call here. We have Rick and Eugene on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Melissa Bays-Burke from the University of Oregon.
Hello, Jeffrey.
Hi.
Yes, every time I hear the recording from Ronald Reagan, Mr. Gorbachev teared down this wall, I hear it in the past tense.
How so?
Well, Mr. Gorbachev teared down this wall rather than the imperative.
Interesting. So you're hearing an extra D there that he
yes.
certainly didn't intend. And what do you make of that?
I don't know why I hear it every time in the recording.
Okay.
I don't know why.
Let's see if we have a clue from what that might be from Melissa.
Yeah, it's interesting that you actually hear the D sound because that's the sound, of course, that starts down after the tear, right? So tear down this wall. If you pause long enough there, that could be a cue to the listener that the D is extra long, and that's what we do when there are two sounds in English that are right next to each other and identical. So if you think about something like the word sub-basement, you make the B in that very long, and the way you make that B long is by pausing. And so it's possible that in pausing or making the speech extra clear, Reagan actually did the opposite by making it sound like there should be two D's there, right, tear down this wall.
Right, yeah, and the fact that, and it reminds me, too, of the fact that, that people do speak very differently, even if they completely understand each other. I mean, you have people who do have a what I call a sonorous quality, where like with Vin Scully, where every word sort of goes into the next one, sort of singy-like, and people like me who tend to keep their words all sort of separate.
Yeah, there are definitely differences in style of speech, and one of the really fascinating things that we still don't understand very well in speech research is how we as listeners do such an amazing job of communicating with people who we've never heard before. So you can hear my voice for the first time on this radio station and understand probably most of what I'm saying, even though you don't have a ton of experience with me and even though I speak probably differently in some ways than anyone else you've heard before. And we don't have a great understanding of how listeners do that sort of normalization in the face of a hugely variable signal. So this is really complex and interesting stuff that we're still trying to unpack.
I looked over one bit of research you did that involved listening to people speaking English. One person was a Spanish speaker by nature, and another one was an Irish speaker of English, and a person who had a problem with the muscles of speech. And so what were some of the results you found out of that research?
Yeah, for that study, we were really interested in whether accented speech is processed similarly to other sorts of challenging listening conditions in terms of different speakers. And we found some really interesting results that suggested that in some ways there are some similarities. So we found the non-native speaker patterning in some interesting ways with the Irish English speaker whose native language was English. But in some ways, there weren't strong correlations, which suggests that maybe individuals who are good at understanding one type of speech are using quite different skills than individuals who are good at using a different type of speech. And so we've been trying to follow this up, looking at some cognitive tests, looking at factors like working memory and cognitive flexibility to see if any of those things might help us predict when someone is going to be good at understanding a specific type of unfamiliar speech and when they're not. That work is still in progress, and the jury's a little bit out on that. But I think it's a really interesting question, in part because we're interested in getting people better at communication, right, in the broad scheme of things. And so I think that an attempt to understand what makes people good in the first place will help us in the future with intervention.
Well, particularly as it relates to education, I mean, are there some particularly good things that you've developed that help teachers know how to speak clearly to people who are not native speakers of English or how to at least to get a sense for whether they've been understood?
Yeah, we're working right now on some projects that look at the specific properties of clear speech as they help non-native speakers. So we're looking at it from the angle of how non-native speakers can make their speech more clear. And there's some existing evidence that if you're a highly proficient non-native speaker, you're pretty good at this. Native speakers are great at making their speech more clear when they have to make it more clear as a general rule. But it's less clear that low proficiency speakers are able to do this. And of course, they're the ones who it's sort of most critical for them to be able to speak more clearly because they're more likely to not be understood in the first place. So that's some other work that's going on in the lab right now. And while we're not developing direct interventions, I think our work can really help inform future interventions.
Melissa Bays-Burke is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange from the Department of Linguistics at the University of Oregon. Can ears attuned to a particular region be retrained? If you come, for example, from a part of the country where you hear pen and pin as the same thing, can you learn to differentiate between them?
Yeah, absolutely. So both in terms of regional dialects, that's possible, and also in terms of native languages. So one of the critical features of native language phonology, which is the sound systems of those languages, is that we learn to ignore things that aren't important in our language. So a really good example of this is a native Japanese speaker doesn't need to know the difference in Japanese between R and L. Those two sounds are not different in their language. But with some amount of training, we can help native Japanese speakers learn to differentiate those sounds in English. And that training ends up being quite successful depending on some of the properties of that training. But that's something that I'm quite interested in, how we can newly tune our ears to speech, both of different dialectal varieties and also of different language varieties. And that's something we're working on intensively in our lab, helping native English speakers perceive new sounds in other languages in hopes of better understanding how that retuning happens in the first place.
Joy and Talent by email wants to know if your own speech style changed as a result of your studies.
You know, I don't know if my own speech style changed as a result of my studies. I think my own speech style changed as a function of moving around the country from Michigan, where I grew up, to Boston for college and then out to Oregon for work. I think my speech style probably changed as a function of kind of absorbing some of the features that surrounded me in various places.
And I have to ask before we go, the trend in TV news to put subtitles on the screen when a person speaks heavily accented English, I wonder what you think when you see that.
Well, I think two things. You know, personally, I feel a little bit sad that we have to have subtitles for people who don't sound exactly like us. But I think in some ways it also helps. We do know that if you support the auditory signal with some sort of visual signal, like writing, it does help in perception in the end. So hopefully that's something that's helping the listener instead of pointing out that this person isn't exactly like you.
And just a few seconds left. With our native language, I mean, what we speak naturally, are we in for a tougher understanding later in life? Does expertise in speech production decline while the ears are going too?
That's a really good question. And there's some evidence that as hearing declines, your ability to do a wide variety of different things also declines. But the good news is learning new languages is possible, even very late in life. It might just be a little bit more tricky for a variety of reasons.
Okay, good to know. French class, we'll start booking it now. Melissa Bays-Burke is an assistant professor in the Department of Linguistics at the University of Oregon. She's also the director of the University of Oregon Second Language Acquisition and Teaching Certificate Program. She's been our guest in this month's edition of Curious Research Meets Radio. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.